Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden.
Ryan Christern is director of the ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom, based in London. He's well qualified intellectually. He began by reading the history of political and religious thought at Cambridge, and then made a demanding spiritual journey as a Catholic seminarian, studying philosophy at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas in Rome, and theology at the Pontifical Gregorian. But he found himself being drawn back to work for the church and society as a layman, and he now leads the advocacy efforts of ADF International in the UK. He acts as a liaison for politicians, media, the other NGO allies working on shared mission issues, and writes regularly on the relationship between philosophy, law, and freedom of expression. I came to know him through the work of some friends, all of whom were working to defend the integrity of Catholic education. He knows as much about the culture wars and their effects in threatening freedom of speech and freedom of conscience as any Catholic, and brings an incisive mind to the issues facing the Church and a well-honed spiritual discernment underpinning it. And he joins me now.
Ryan, good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's lovely to see you again. Thank you for joining us. You're director of ADF. Not everyone will know what ADF stands for. Can we start by your telling us what the organization is and what you do in it?
So ADF stands for the Alliance Defending Freedom. It was initially established in the US around a quarter of a century ago and has been in Europe over a decade. We exist to allow people to live and speak the truth as freely as is appropriate, with the Christian understanding of freedom being the important for emphasis there. So freedom isn't an absolute value in what we do. The truth is the absolute value. But we believe that there's a particular role for organizations like ourselves to both speak to what a true notion of freedom is and to defend fundamental freedoms that the living out and the speaking of the faith rely on.
Before we get to you, let's just talk a bit about that. I was quite proud of myself as I look back and tell my own story and journey to this. It was around about the millennium that I noticed, working in a university, that the consequences of the cultural and intellectual movements that were beginning to hot up were going to affect freedom of speech. I could only see it in theory, but I thought it was extremely likely. But if the ADF was started in America 25 years ago, that's very prescient. What was it that led the prescient founders to such a clear sense that freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of conscience was going to be under attack, that they started an organization?
Now, I may be giving them less credit than they're due, because I know some of them and they're extraordinarily strategic individuals. So I may be underselling it here, but I think the American context is key. And I think there's been some providence in the fact that that American context has been the foundation for a ministry that has become extremely relevant outside of the US. Namely, because obviously the founding fathers and a certain, you know, I think traditional reading of the Constitution and the notion of the type of broadly liberal approach to constitution, individual, society that America was founded on is quite different to ours. And I think the notion that you'd speak to these fundamental freedoms as enshrined in the Constitution is like swimming in water. And particularly a quarter of a century ago in the US, it's a bit more contentious now, one might argue. And so I think there was just a fairly straightforward recognition that actually, in practice, some of those freedoms, which everyone agrees on, were under threat. And there was no strategic pushback from a conservative legal or a conservative Christian, or orthodox rather, Christian perspective. And that big battles were being lost in the courts and elsewhere on these key issues that, again, it's a bit like a rolling stone, or the sooner it starts rolling, the more momentum it picks up. And I think they were wise enough to recognize the direction of travel all that time ago. Now, in Europe, it started, our speaking of kind of fundamental freedoms that aren't the Magna Carta, a slightly more, I think, contemporary, actually. I think there's a contemporary appeal to fundamental freedoms that is quite new and quite an acute response to the cultural moment we're in.
So you're saying that there's a kind of hypersensitivity in American culture because of the First Amendment, and that my sense is that in Europe, our fathers, maybe in your case, grandfather's generation, did the fighting of freedom of speech. And having seen the Nazis off on the one hand and built a wall between us and the East on the other, everyone relaxed a bit. And it's only really quite recently we've woken up to the fact that fundamental freedom of speech is under threat. It's come very quickly in Europe, hasn't it? I mean, really, it's swept on us in the last 10 years with enormous rapidity.
Yeah, it has come on quickly. But I'd even challenge that. I know you weren't staking out a narrative, but I'd challenge any implicit narrative in that even, that in the 50s that maybe my grandfather felt he was fighting for freedom of speech in that sense. I think it was probably a lot simpler in their minds than that. And I think notions of good and evil, even Christendom, frankly, and your nation as being something worthy of defense in a wholesome way, not just in a, you know, a kind of the nation as always ending up in a kind of negative nationalism. I think all of those elements are really present in that pre-war, during the war and post-war period. I think this notion that we need to protect freedom of speech for its own sake has come out, as we say, as a result of there being challenged to it for the first time in an extraordinarily long time, probably, yeah, I mean, for at least a couple of hundred years, right, in the acute way that we're starting to see it in law and culture.
I was just reading, in order to give myself a better Catholic education, I've been reading Peter Ackroyd on the Tudors. and there was a marvellous moment just as Lady Jane Grey and Queen Mary were about to exchange when a small baker boy in London shouted, Queen Mary's got a decent claim to the throne, whereupon someone grabbed him, imprisoned him, and they cut his ears off the following morning, down to the root, it said. I thought, yeah. Well, there we go. Freedom of speech has not always been at a premium in the streets of London. So you're right. That was 500 years ago. But we've had the luxury of it, really, for quite some time. I guess ever since the 18th century and the cartoonists, probably, we've enjoyed a certain amount of freedom. But it's really, it's come under threat so much that actually, it's only in the last few years that everyone's even begun to notice, in terms of employment rights, that it applies pretty well to everyone. Before that, it was, well, these loudmouthed people who had pretty unpleasant opinions got themselves into trouble, and any common sense person would want to slap them down a bit. We don't mind. I think that's how people saw the kind of campaign that you and I might have been wanting to defend a decade ago. But now it's pretty much agreed that freedom of speech is under threat everywhere. What do you make of the arguments that they're presented from the left that actually freedom of speech is a right-wing instinct designed to give a platform to bigotry and has no greater merit than that?
Yeah, I think it's the result of there being no positive vision for freedom in and of itself, which as Christians we have. And it's the result of a Marxist and then, I think, critical theory approach to language and discourse that enables people to trash anyone else's freedom for anything other than the political end that they're seeking, which are often systematic on the extreme left, right? I don't want to characterize all left-wing politics like this, far from it. But I think the root of normalizing that approach to speech comes from seeing everything as power dynamics and power structure, and that then legitimizes your reaction to freedom as not necessarily good in and of itself. Because even if, as we're seeing with some of the more radical claims from the critical theorists now, the woke movement, as most people would know of it, even if you are speaking freely in a way that is reasonably inoffensive and you have no intent to offend, that actually isn't relevant, because intent and objective content of speech aren't the lens in which this is being viewed. This is being viewed with regards to the power dynamics between different identity groups within society who themselves make the claim on what is oppressive or not about speech. And that means there is no standard of freedom or shared notion of freedom or the good of freedom in and of itself. It doesn't have a good.
So I wanted to sum that up by saying that you and I, as Christians, as Catholic Christians, would say we understand truth and freedom as objectively valuable, but in the cultural and political context we're in at the moment, what we would take for granted isn't shared at all. And the real moral virtue comes in the moral exercise of the redistribution of power. Redistribution, because the sin in political terms is that the wrong people have the wrong amount. Would that be a fair way of describing the two worlds?
That's exactly right. And then in the middle, you have the liberals, the old liberals, many of whom were Marxists back in the day, but actually have too much built-in common sense to be anything other than fighting the liberal cause now, because they recognize what's at stake for society and for public discourse. And it's been fascinating as an advocate to see and in Westminster that people who would not have worked together or vehemently disagree on key moral or social issues have clubbed together in the last decade because there's an absolute necessity to do so for the sake of free and commonsensical public discourse. And so I think the liberals are the genuine liberals that are left, and there aren't that many actually in practice, I think, that see it through, that principle through, find themselves in a really squeezed position as well right now.
So in terms of what we just described about a new shift in the philosophical platforms that we engage with, one of the people who's really annoys the left enormously is Alexander Dugin, who's supposed to be a philosopher who's advising Putin. We don't know if he is or not. But one of the things I've heard him say that I thought was quite impressive when I was on a seminar with him was that they're looking for a new fourth way of understanding the world. So communism, Marxism has failed. Fascism has failed. Nobody wants that. But interestingly enough, the Western experiment of liberalism, thing you've just been describing, instinctive people happening, but that's also failed as well. So they're making common cause with you and I at the moment as they're instinctively they see that's required. And so Dugin was suggesting that in Russian terms, at any rate, what they're looking for is the need to form some new philosophy which in their case takes account of Russian nationalism. Now, that's not going to appeal to people in the West, but the project itself, that we need something bigger to deal with this gap. Are we looking for a new kind of philosophical resurgence of Christianity? Is that, I mean, should we be thinking that energetically and that ambitiously? Because if we don't find something that the old failed liberalism can slip into that isn't exactly the same as Christendom, obviously, but needs to be based on what you and I would think of as objective values like truth and beauty. If we didn't produce that, it's not going to exist.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very hard to, in practice, achieve anything other than saving as much of the good of the liberal principles in terms of how our institutions work. For example, equal opportunity or, you know, in the broadest commonsensical sense, fairness, and you know, the idea that there'll be neutrality in judgments for its own sake. Like, those things are actually under threat right now with the new philosophy that we're facing. And so in practice, there are still quite a lot of liberal fumes in the tanks. Our institutions are set up to work on Christian roots and liberal principles on top, if you like. And so the simplest route back is a realignment of the best of the liberal principles with a sense that actually those roots wither without there being some underlying ethic. And at the very least, Christianity has a significant part to play in any society that wants to continue to uphold standards of justice and fairness and true equality and beyond just the political, those that hold political power. But that's the case we have to make as Christians and as the church. And I feel like we've lost our confidence in making that case in the public square. One of the reasons Joseph Ratzinger, as an individual, I think is such an intellectual hero for many who are even not Christian right now, is that he could articulate this in a way that was systematic and compelling and very relevant to Europe at this juncture. And that was certainly a massive influence on me as a young man too.
I agree passionately. I've only really discovered Ratzinger recently, not in the sense I didn't read him and like him and appreciate him, but the clarity of the way he articulates the Christian view is just hugely helpful. But how are we going to do this? Because the progressives have played a very clever game. They've taken all the Christian language and they've hollowed out the center of it and given it a different center. So equality, which we all agree, you call it equality of opportunity, they make it equality of outcome. Diversity, which we see as being the largesse of a creator God in his love and infinite variety, diversity for them becomes a weapon to attack well-honed communities who understand themselves and have different values from the progressive one. Inclusion sounds a lovely way of making sure that migrants and vagrants aren't left on the edge of society, but actually what it really means is you're not allowed to exercise the gift of discernment between good and evil because everything gets included in red. So what they've done is they've taken the Christian language and they've given it an anti-Christian meaning. And though so philosophically tying our hands, my own sense is that this leaves me very frustrated, but also much more determined to do a Ratzinger and to articulate as clearly as possible the principles of Christendom, you know, without the kind of delicate nuance, everyone's entitled to their own view, but more fire, the house is burning down. isn't it an invitation to us to really get our act together and speak with much more vigour and coherence as Christians?
It really is. I love this new verb, to do a Ratzinger. We should pass out what that means exactly. But I think there's a real opportunity pastorally, and there's a real opportunity intellectually, because what's really interesting for me about the woke phenomenon, which is something more like a cult than a worldview that's coherent. It's got mantras that, like you say, are cannibalistic on Christian notions, and therefore...
Oh, that's the word. Beautiful word.
But also... it appeals to the best of us, you know, our human nature, like to be kind and inclusive. And people don't have the toolkit right now within society and within the church, I think, to be able to parse out why this notion of equality is different and insidious and runs counter to the gospel and the created order and the dignity of each individual. And I think that's step one. So whilst some, you know, liberals have very ably started to deconstruct how the postmodern movement in all of its forms is nihilistic and hopeless and just deconstructive, and they've also been able to point out that that's been weaponized, that circular reasoning within the philosophy of woke has been weaponized and attached to mantras that you can't argue with, and that's a threat to everything we hold dear about the West. They've been able to do that reasonably well, but those liberals have no solution other than liberalism, which, as you've already noted and Ratzinger writes about so well, can't sustain itself. It relies on something else. And so I feel like we have a job to do in the intellectual sphere. One, let's parse out what this really means. And people within the church have the intellectual ability to do so and the cultural reach to do so, like yourself, frankly, Gavin, have a duty to start doing this. What does it really mean? Where's this philosophy really come from? Where does it actually lead us? Why is it hopeless, actually? Why is it not as benign as you think? This isn't about being kind to people, ultimately. Why is it incompatible with the gospel? And then pastorally, I do think, you know, this philosophy is very puritanical in its application. Out of necessity, it's divisive by design, because it's about identity tribes warring with each other. And it leads to a coarsity and a bitterness and a hard-edged nature to all of our public discourse on human relationships. And I think people are starting to realize that now. People don't like this new culture that's starting to grow around them. And I think even Gen Z are seeing it quite clearly. There's a counter zeitgeist to this. And so as the church, in that fuzzy general sense, we can just live different and be different and be there to pick up the pieces too. I fear we're not being very creative about that right now.
Well, so back at you. You're a Catholic intellectual. You've got a degree in intellectual history from Cambridge and from Rome. We'll talk about that in a moment. One of the reasons that I'm so glad to be a Catholic, and I need to try and find ways of saying this that don't evoke old patterns of tribalism and partisan. But one of the reasons that I'm so glad to become a Catholic recently is because it seems to me only the Catholic Church has the resources to combat what you've just described, that monolithic, cannibalistic cult that pretends to be good, uses the language of goodness, but actually produces the most diabolical, literally, outcomes. But only Catholicism has a belief, an unyielding belief in the sanctity of life that provides a platform upon which everything else can be built. And without it, and liberal Protestants have tried to do it without it and failed, nothing happens. Only Catholics have a magisterium which provides them with a muscular system of values that allows them to engage in a philosophical discussion, saying, well, here is a hypothetical expression of the truth and the way it's been applied in the past. We know it works. We've been trying it out for a long time. Some of the best minds in culture for 1,500 years have been working through this. Now, again, Protestants can't do that. They have their own preferred philosophers. You might enjoy Kierkegaard if you're given to sort of slightly gloomy prognostications, but there's nothing within Protestantism, and particularly not within pious evangelicalism or Pentecostalism, that matches this immensely well thought out and well tried out philosophical capacity that Catholics have. Isn't it time the Catholics in Europe and the Catholics in this country said, we're better at this than other people, not we personally, but the tradition we've inherited. It's the only answer. I'm not sure what the implications of standing up and saying it is only the church that has a due competence to respond to this very dangerous cultural movement we're on. But I can't think of anything else, and I want to go around saying this because, frankly, I'm convinced of it. Why aren't our bishops, why aren't our public intellectuals, why aren't the Catholic voices in Europe, in our community, why haven't they seen how dangerous this is and leading the charge with all the resources we have?
I think there's a few things to point out there. Let me start with the resources available outside of the Catholic community, because I do think there is a new conflagration of cultural movements that mean that many of my evangelical, formerly Protestant friends or even colleagues do have the tools to combat this in practice. And I think it's largely as a result of some of the not doctrinal, but conventional distinctives that were seen as absolute culturally between denominations are starting to dissolve. The key one, I think, is that you don't touch natural law if you're not Catholic. I think there's been my generation and below aren't part of that old conversation that we don't engage in Catholic-type philosophical discussion and natural law discussion, and we reject the natural law approach. What I'm seeing in practice is, for various reasons, non-Catholics recognizing that the natural law approach is the Western approach, it's the scientific approach, it's the approach that built our legal institutions, our understanding of ourselves. It's what liberalism is built on to some degree in and of itself. And that is a weapon that we simply have to become okay with. Whereas I think 30 years ago, within certain churches, there would have been quite a dogmatic, in a general sense, rejection of this way of approaching philosophy and engaging with it. So I'm really heartened by that. And so I do think it's possible outside of the Catholic context to have the Western way of approaching epistemology, a theory of knowledge, right, of the natural law, of law and culture, and at the same time saying, hey, here's the gospel, here's Jesus Christ. I think that combination can be super effective, and I see many, many people who are not Catholic doing that beautifully. But I think what you're saying is right. I feel personally as a Catholic that it's all just built in, and it's at the heart of our whole approach to reality, and it becomes a second nature for us to have the response to this, and that therefore confers on us a particular duty and responsibility to respond to as individuals, and then of course as a church, hierarchical, militant, whatever. And so I do think it's that time for us to each examine our consciences and say, we've been given more, we believe, each of us who personally affirms to be Catholic does believe it's the truth in its fullness. If that is the case, we've been given more than others, and we have a bigger responsibility than others as well. And in particular to this current culture, which is the very definition of pastoral. And so it drives me nuts that in so many contexts, we have this false dichotomy between the intellectual, the theological, and the pastoral, because there is no separation in reality. Bad ideas, bad theology has real victims, and we see this every day in our ministry.
I think I just want to say very quickly, in case anyone thinks I was being reactively anti-Protestant as a fresh flush of conversionism, I don't think I was. My sense is that in terms of the spectrum of sexuality particularly, and in terms also of the whole abortion and euthanasia debate, within Protestantism, there's a sliding scale of such complexity that it's very hard to get enough people to gather at one point on the scale to make a movement. Whereas the Catholic teaching about these areas is, you know, lots of people don't recognize it. It would be foolish not to say that. But the teaching's there. The magisterium is there. The weight of the authority of the church is there if we want to use it. Let's go back to you. You were destined to go in a different direction. When did you think you had a call to the priesthood, and how did it manifest itself?
I think it was a really interesting cultural context in me feeling like I was called to the priesthood. And it's partly a result of, and I won't say calls to the priesthood, a result of dysfunction per se. But in my case, I think there was an element of that I can now look back on and say something about the society and the church I grew up in. And that's because I grew up in a city called Hull, which, you know, wasn't exactly full of practicing young Catholics and wasn't full of practicing young families, Catholic families either. You know, and I was in a household of a single mother had come back to her faith when I was about 10 years old or so, in quite a serious way, out of the blue, which was really interesting for me to experience, and being an only child. And so I would be going to, let's say, it'd be a Thursday evening mass. There'd be like 25 old ladies, a couple of old men, and me and my mum and the priest. And that was what convicted Catholicism looked like in my early teens. And so I think very naturally, I hadn't experienced the positive of the vocation of marriage and family life. I couldn't describe it because I hadn't lived it in that sense. I have an incredible mother who I think is a saint of God and did an amazing job, but that's a different thing, right? To having experienced the full goodness of the nuclear family and the plan of God. And one of the things my mother did, which I'm really grateful for, was she gave me permission to recognize that in my life as I was growing up and introduced me to good father figures in my life too. I'm in that context, and I'm starting to believe that Catholicism's true after a big struggle and a very serious spiritual experience that kept me practicing when I was going to leave the faith as a teenager. I received an incredible experience of God's love the night I was going to tell my mother that I wasn't going to go to church anymore. After receiving communion that evening at Mass, I was rendered speechless for hours with the power of that experience of his love, which kept me in the fold for a period of time.
It just happened.
It just happened, yeah. I had chickened out for about 2 weeks of telling my mum that I wasn't going to go to church anymore because I knew it meant a lot to her. And the night where I was like, I'm definitely going to tell her tonight, on the car on the way to Mass, I chickened out again. And then all the way through Mass, I was having a dialogue with God, in effect. And so I was disposed to his grace in that sense. You know, I wasn't implicitly very disposed to his grace. I was having a radically honest conversation with him. And I was like, listen, I'm going to tell her after Mass. I'm not coming to Mass anymore. And I received communion, and I just was completely overwhelmed by an experience that words can't describe of complete and utter love. My mother, being the holy woman she is, was very chill about it. She's just like, yeah, okay, no worries. I was just weeping and couldn't speak for hours.
Oh, wow.
And then later that evening, when I recovered my senses properly, I said, Mom, I was going to tell you tonight, I'm not coming to Mass anymore, and I don't know what to do. So that spiritual experience kept me going for a while, and really it was an intellectual conversion that followed over those teenage years. And the context for that increasing personal, rational conviction of the truth of Catholicism came in a context by which what radical Catholicism looks like in my context is priesthood.
Yeah.
The only really radically practicing young men in that sense were priests. And the priesthood in of itself is so objectively romantic and extraordinary and speaks so well of Christ. If you have a good priest in particular in your midst, then I was very blessed to know a number of clergy who were mostly under the age of 50, 60, very intellectually serious, very normal guys, but had a service-oriented approach and a pastoral approach that was breathtaking in its selflessness. That impacted on me in extraordinary ways. I don't think you can ever really fully understand yourself in just rational analysis. I think it's just something that washes over you. And so I'm not saying that would make it inevitable that I would then try my vocation, but I felt that I had certain charisms that matched what a good priest might be. And whilst that might be true, the bottom line was, to cut to the end of the story, I had to recognize after a few years in seminary that I was not going to serve my baptismal vocation very well by going forward to ordination. And by baptismal vocation, I mean my vocation to holiness as an individual and being close to the Lord. And I had to recognize that pragmatically, like discerning a state of life, you know, we're used to saying, oh, I'd rather be a Benedictine than a Dominican because I feel called to that kind of liturgy and to living those kind of hours, right? We're used to talking about the pragmatic discernment about a state of life when we're comparing religious orders. But it's also true for a state of life itself. And what is the current context of secular priesthood? And for me, I knew that it would accentuate the dangers for me to be a bad Catholic man to the maximum. It would mean I'm more likely to be isolated, living on my own, that I have to pretend to be someone I'm not, and more likely, which, you know, I, like many of us, are prone to in all sorts of ways, that there isn't going to be real community and fraternity for me necessarily, even if I put quite a lot of effort into making it happen, etc. and etc. etc. I wasn't comfortable being part of a culture of decline management being acceptable, and I knew that if I was to be ordained, I would have to be comfortable with really being obedient to what the hierarchy asked of me in my day-to-day, in my week-to-week. And am I humble enough? And is it the Lord's calling on me to accept that? Or am I called to be part of a creative minority in a different way? I still, on balance, it was really clear that having given the Lord a good period of time in summary to say, you can intervene here, I'm going to leave if you don't intervene. It was, you know, so I was like, I took them. And after 4 years or so, 4.5 years, I left training. But I feel really blessed to have had that experience.
So moving this on from you to your analysis, I mean, first of all, thank you very much for such a very moving story. Your analysis then is that secular priesthood at the moment carries more burdens than it needs or it ought, particularly because it imposes a real loneliness on the priests and the clergy. And there isn't enough structural or existential or pastoral or psychological or spiritual support. People are left pretty exposed. And I think most people, just looking at the way the poor clergy have to operate, would agree with you.
Yeah, I think it's really tough right now. And one of the things that, being in seminary, you have the privilege of being on long placements, right, where you can accompany parish priests in what they do. And I remember thinking, as a result, after my third placement or whatever it was, what's the theme I have here? One, it's that we don't appreciate these guys enough. They've literally given their lives to us in love and self-sacrifice. You know, for all their imperfections, that is the baseline reality of what's going on here when you're interacting with your priest that I think is so easy to forget. It's so easy for us as lay people to miss that call to what they're doing. I would say the particular living out of celibate priesthood, right, as a sign of God's love for us, is that they've wedded each of us individually, all at the same time in the way God can love us completely individually. You know, it's an analogy of that, an imperfect analogy of that. We forget that fundamental, and then that can lead to all sorts of resentments leading with regards to our relationship with clergy and not appreciating them. And I saw consistently standing, you know, alongside them or placement, people just taking them for granted as though they were doing it for self-service or doing it because, you know, the general instruction of the Roman Missal was their agenda, or because they had invented the hard truths of Christ themselves. And, you know, I just think there is a real kind of, for want of a better term, PR issue between the clergy and the laity right now, and a misunderstanding of just how special that service is and just how utterly romantic and beautiful that self-giving is that they're offering to us day on day. You know, some of the priests I had long placements with would be up at 6 a.m., you know, doing a holy hour for their laity that their laity didn't know about. And then at 8:30, I'd be in a meeting where they were just being abused, frankly, because people had legitimate frustrations with parish accounts or whatever. So it's just, I think there's a real mismatch in communication right now about understanding what the priesthood is at its heart for those that are giving it in love. And then, as you allude to, I think there have been changes in practice that are partly as a result of demographic decline that have left clergy in practice far more isolated than they would have been 30 years ago. It's normal to live alone now. That should be abnormal, actually.
Yeah. Absolutely.
As Christians, we're not made to live alone. And we've normalized something that is abnormal just because we've floated into that practice, frankly, in the last 30 years.
I think one of the problems of Reformation is that it produces a kind of schism of gifts and perceptions. I mean, one of the lovely things about many Protestant communities is they have it's sometimes criticized as being a bit banal, but they do have a sense of the congregation of family, church is family. And so there's a sense that people exercising Christian ministry are legitimately part of that family. And again, perhaps it ought to be the role of the bishops to come and troubleshoot congregations and say, are you behaving like a family? Is this a community or is it a parody of some form of institutional hierarchy where there's no touch on our common human needs? It's very interesting that what you're really saying is the problem of the secular priesthood is not sex and sexuality, it's loneliness. And so, I mean, sex then becomes a symptom of the lonely disorder of loneliness. But because we're so completely obsessed with sex in our society, we can't get beyond it to get to the problem of loneliness that it springs out of. I think that's very wise. I had one point I was asked to look at a post which involved looking after the Anglican bishops. And one of the things I discovered as I prepared for the interviews was how incredibly lonely and dysfunctional they were, because in a way that wasn't dissimilar structurally from the Catholic priesthood, they were completely isolated. Nobody took care of them. There was no sense, either personally or corporately, of is this functional or dysfunctional? And if it's dysfunctional, how can we mend it? If it's functional, how can we amplify it? Just was just nobody's responsibility, which is a very bad way of running an organization. But I can see that the same thing applies even at the basic parochial level within the Catholic Church. And it's a shame because it puts so much pressure on people who already have too much pressure on them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I recognize when I started seminary, a good priest was a priest that called fellow clergy once a month. It's like, no, Jerry, how are you doing? You know, and like Jerry is going to appreciate the call. You're good for actually proactively calling your fellow clergy. But, you know, Jerry isn't going to say, you know what, Tom, I'm not seeing my office anymore because I just don't see the point. I've slipped in out of practice. I'm up late at night, you know, having a bit too much to drink and, you know, kind of addicted to porn casually. And, you know, my faith is still there, but I'm kind of listless, to be honest. Tom's not going to say that on a monthly call. The things that are going to pick up on that actually are having the kind of relationships with people that can hold you to account in love. And that requires a level of knowing each other and being in community, praying together in particular, where you can start to point these things out for each other and ask for accountability from your brothers and sisters in Christ. And I'm not saying every priest needs to live in like super intense community, but I do think what we have now as standard is a weird, very contemporary extreme that is very difficult to be a really good Christian man in. And I knew for me, I am not strong enough to resist the downsides of that way of living. I have to have the humility finally to recognize that I need accountability in my life as a Christian man.
I think that's obviously very wise. Is there anybody within the church whose job it is to rethink the way in which clergy and parish structurally cohere in a more generative way? I mean, my sense is that we've got institutions, you described it very beautifully, it's failing institutionals and institution syndrome. So everyone's just working too hard, peddling to keep the thing from sinking too fast. And no one is stepping aside and saying, some radical rethinking that needs to take place here. Not rethinking for the sake of being novel, but rethinking for the sake of reconfiguring dynamics that aren't working and aren't really damaging. It's silly to talk patly of loving our neighbour whilst we continue to support institutions that strangle our neighbour.
It's true. And I think there's an understandable temptation that right now within Catholic circles to say, we tried things and they failed. I'll give examples we tried catechizing and catechizing doesn't work. So we need to not focus on catechizing. It's like, no, we haven't been catechizing systematically since the 60s. Mm. Actually, it's not like we were trying it for the last 30 years and it failed. Let's be honest. We lost confidence in what we're catechizing post-Vatican II, right? The laity failed to step up, you know, is the headline, I think. And of course, clergy can enable this in all sorts of ways. But, you know, as a layman, I want to take responsibility, you know, for my part of the church and say, you know, we didn't catechize. We lost confidence. We didn't systemically catechize. It's not when we tried it and failed it. The parish. There's all sorts of conversations about whether the parish is something to continue with. We haven't been doing parish properly for ages now. It's not like we're trying it and it's failing. It's the social, economic, cultural conditions that make a parish a natural unit that works have started to be pulled apart, right? Yeah. By this increasingly atomistic society we live in, where you've got very few families in, let's say, an average parish in London that actually live in the parish, will be at the parish on a regular basis, aren't in France half the year on, whatever. And so we just have these new realities to deal with. It's not like catechization, the parish, basic community and prayer somehow have been tried and failed. It's the all sorts of things have conspired to make these things extremely difficult, or we just stop doing it by default. And I think there's an awful lot of solutions here that aren't rocket science to, you know, us being where we need to be, which usually involve like, well, let's actually catechize them. And let's combine that with putting food on every Thursday night when we do it. So the kids are fed for the parents that might come, and just really commonsensical, community-focused things like this. And then I think there's innovation needed in areas like cost of living and the ability to have large families as Catholics. I think if there's any area where I think the church institutional with its resources could start to be innovative, it's around things like, okay, you can't afford to live in the parish anymore because you're open to life. Instead of closing down this church in the deanery and selling it off to be a nursing home, we're going to redevelop it into housing, or we're going to be the primary investors and owners in that redevelopment. And we're going to give chicken feed rent to Catholic families who are going to live on site instead, who will serve the local community that we plan to build. Like, I think there are genuinely innovative pastoral responses to the issues that make doing parish well problematic now, for example. Just as there are, I think, a place for the church in responding to sex addiction and various other things like that, which a lot of secular people are looking for help with that we could provide.
In my early days as an Anglican evangelical, I thought it was a no-brainer that in a large parish, and my first parish had over 1,000 people in it, some enormously competent professionals, that one of the things we should be doing, be providing legal aid, medical aid,
yep,
financial aid, a whole load of competences that we had as a community. And okay, so the parish of 1,000 was unusual, but nonetheless, within a diocese, you can still have the resources to make a church family in which,
yep,
help, that kind of practical help would bond the community together in a way that expressed the love more than just the necessity of existential experience. Look, we've moved to you and I to renewing the church, perhaps because that was something's been on our mind. Let me give you 5 minutes to talk about the work of ADF. You're heavily involved in helping teachers, Catholic employees, people who are in trouble with the zeitgeist. I'm sorry to have taken so much time on other things, although what we've been talking about is enormously important, and I hope it might spark a spin-off in other circles. But let's give the ADF some due. What's your day job?
Yeah, we do an awful lot of work defending people's fundamental freedoms, and those fundamental freedoms that allow Catholics, in this case, to live out and speak the truth. And it's that public square living out that we've seen increasingly squeezed, right, by, as you say, the zeitgeist. And where the rubber hits the road is where we step in. So whether it be you've been sacked for being Orthodox Catholic in a reasonable way, not in a provocative way, we'll often be the organization that steps in to defend you legally. We work on the root causes of the things that can lead people going to court. So whether it be legislation, whether it be policy with government departments, we recognize that the most efficient work and actually the greatest cultural change in our age has come from organizations working on those things in a really concentrated way. And so we are called to work in those areas too, if we're going to be smart in what we do and efficient in what we do. And then lastly, one of the things that really attracted me personally to working for ADF, Gavin, and looking towards the US, frankly, is that ADF's really serious about training a generation of future leaders who will impact law and culture in a way that actually equips them to change the world. You know, it's easy to say that, and it's very difficult and very resource intensive to do. And I'm really glad to say that with the Blackstone program in the US that trains lawyers to ultimately become, you know, like Amy Coney Barrett, Supreme Court Justice. In Europe, we have a training program called Arete for young professionals that might want to change law and culture. And we equip them to do that, and we integrate them into a community that works with each other lifelong to do that too. And we think the ultimate solution to our moment is going to be institutional renewal. I'm really committed to that institutional renewal, because otherwise everything else is just going to be increasingly shrinking lifeboats in the culture. And I feel like my children's generation and my grandchildren's generation can do better for them than increasingly shrinking lifeboats, to be honest.
This is, I think this is a whole new conversation we ought to have. And we're only halfway through what we were talking about. But we mustn't tax people's attention spans further than we have already. That's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for being so articulate and informed. and creatively helpful. It's really a wonderful conversation to have with you. Ryan, thank you so much for spending the time. Bless you.